This is The Takeaway for Thursday, August 3rd, 2017.
And we're back at Takeaway National Golf Club for the annual President's Cup here. President Donald Trump is deep in the rough on 14. He's two strokes up on the leaderboard over Barack Obama, who hasn't played quite as much golf as the current commander-in-chief, but he's up against a strong field in the final round here.
Dwight Eisenhower, a president by trade, belts a beauty far down the fairway.
Nixon told reporters, "I'm just fine, and I'm going to play good golf today."
Gerald Ford is known for keeping the crowd on its toes when he's playing golf.
I'd go play golf and it'd be five holes before I'd hit a good shot because I'd be so preoccupied.
Yeah. I don't like to take a lot of time playing the game.
It's not unusual for President Obama to go golfing away from the media glare.
To see him out there and hitting shots and, I mean, hit it well.
We're very proud of the golf and golfers.
I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers. Now watch this drive.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. Okay, that was a little fake sports news at the top there. We're not hosting the President's Cup Golf Championships at Takeaway National this year. But it could be true. You know, you have to search pretty hard in the history books to find a president who didn't golf. Teddy Roosevelt was too busy rough riding to play golf. Jimmy Carter, just not interested, basically. But you could fill a stack of scorecards with the golf-loving presidents. You heard just a few of them at the top there. Donald Trump's relationship with golf, though, is deeper than any other president's. It's also a lot more complicated. He owns 17 golf clubs here in the United States and abroad, stretching from Bedminster, New Jersey, to Ireland, to Scotland, and beyond. He spent more time than his golf-loving predecessor on the links as president so far, even though in the campaign, President Trump had this to say.
He played more golf last year than Tiger Woods.
Golf journalist Alan Shipnook recently wrote about that old trope, you can tell a lot about a person by how they play golf. So Shipnick found out just how President Trump plays the game that's so important to him and what it tells us about how he plays in business and in politics.
Now watch this drive.
Thanks, President George W. Bush. Alan Shipnick is senior writer at Sports Illustrated and columnist for golf.com. Alan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I live and work a lot in Washington, and there's a key question around town that you might be able to answer. Not how Donald Trump plays, but how much does he play?
The short answer is a heck of a lot. You know, it's funny that the White House will not confirm his number of rounds of golf, even on days when he's seen with golf clubs in tow. Trump has turned golf into his little dirty secret. And part of it is because he was so critical of Barack Obama during the campaign for playing too much golf. And yet Trump is on a pace to play more than probably any modern president.
Let's focus on what the game means to him personally, when he plays, how he plays, and who he plays with. How important is the game and playing the game to President Trump?
Massively. It's really one of his only hobbies, and it's how he connects with his friends. It's how he networks. It's how he's always done business. We've seen that a little bit since he's been in office playing with the Prime Minister of Japan. And, you know, really for him, it's a chance to get away. And what's interesting is, golfers like me, we lust after all the world's great golf courses. We have our list of all the places we want to play and we check them off. He only wants to play Trump golf courses. That's where he plays his golf. It's where he feels most at home, surrounded by people who have paid for the privilege of joining his club. And I think one of the keys to understanding Trump is that he's this striver from Queens, and he's always been obsessed with kind of the status markers of the ruling class. And you know, he can buy the biggest, gaudiest house in Palm Beach and Mar-a-Lago, but he'll never get into Seminole Golf Club, which is a very old money, very discreet place. And same thing, you know, he would love to be a member of Pine Valley in New Jersey. They won't have him, so he has to build his own club, you know, in Bedminster. And you can go on down the list of the places he'd like to play. He can't get in, so he builds his own course or he buys one and redoes it in Trump fashion.
You write in your piece that President Trump doesn't play a round of golf so much as narrate it. What does that mean?
Well, he never stops talking. His commentary is peppered with hyperbole. Every little thing in his course he wants you to admire. So he'll say, "Are these the most beautiful cart paths you've ever seen? You know, it's just regular old asphalt. And is this the best hamburger you've ever tasted? It's just a hamburger, Donald." And of course, it extends down to the design of the course, the conditioning. he's a salesman at heart, right? That's what he was long before he was a politician, and so he can never quite turn that off. But to his credit, he lavishes attention upon his playing partners, whether they're professional golfers or they're reporters or they're old friends. And I talked to many people for this story who have played golf with Trump, and they all have the same experience. He is like the spotlight is trained on you when you're playing, and he's talking about your golf swing and your putting stroke, and he's asking about your family, and he's asking about your business, and he's bragging about the next deal he's going to do. And people who play golf with Trump almost always enjoy the experience, and they're somewhat energized by it. And he's a good player who gets into the spirit of the matches when they get tight, and he has a habit of making important putts in these matches. And I really didn't talk to anyone who said, oh, I hate playing golf with Trump. They might be exhausted by the experience at the end of it, but for the most part, they find it an enjoyable and somewhat unique kind of round of golf.
So you say Donald Trump is a good golfer. How good is he?
Well, officially, his handicap index is 2.8, which would put him in the probably top 1 or 2% of all golfers. Now, he hasn't posted a score this year. He's only posted a couple scores since 2014. So your handicap index updates every 2 weeks. So he's currently, you know, way behind the times. I think he's a solid golfer. He could break 80 on a lot of golf courses. It's hard to get an exact score for him because he takes a lot of liberties like most golfers do. He hits mulligans. He'll pick up a five-footer and call it a gimme. You know, he might roll the ball into a better lie on the fairway if it's in a divot or whatever. And that's common amongst golfers. It really is. So people want to use those facts to impugn his character, and it's a little bit of a stretch. But what's interesting about Trump is he'll do all those things, and then he'll insist he shot the score that he's claiming, and he'll go to his death defending that. And that's where it gets interesting because it's almost like he doesn't acknowledge the gimmies and the mulligans and these other parts of his game. So it's a little window into his soul, how he sees himself, maybe how the rules are slightly malleable, and just how he conducts his business on and off the golf course.
I mean, I'm not much of a golfer. I duffed as a kid, and that's about it. We played on the public course in Hershey, Pennsylvania, next to Spring Creek. But how important is it to be faithful to the rules for golfers? I mean, is this a big deal? People have said in the campaign, well, Donald Trump cheats at golf. Is that really fair?
It's all about the context. So if your playing partners are taking the same liberties and they don't mind you doing that sort of thing, then it's kind of no harm, no foul. But, you know, one thing that's interesting about Trump is he claimed in a tweet a few years ago he's won 18 club championships. Now, a club championship is a serious deal. You can't roll the ball in the rough, and there are no mulligans in a club championship. And that's real competition where people take it very seriously, almost laughably seriously in some cases. And so, you know, I called all the Trump properties and tried to confirm his club championships, and every single call went unreturned. It was like they didn't want the head pro didn't want to touch that one. So that again is part of the Trump legend. You know, has he really won 18 club championships? That would be an incredible achievement for a golfer. It's hard to really know. It's just another gray area that surrounds him.
Well, Alan Shipnook, you write a lot in this story about Donald Trump on and off the course. And we should leave it with a part of your story that you write extensively about, which are all of the international deals and courses that Donald Trump has built around the world. Because there's a good chance we might hear more about these in the future, especially with investigations that could be touching on President Trump's finances. You bring up one course in particular, a $63 million deal at Turnberry in Scotland. And you kind of warn in this piece that we might be hearing more about it.
Well, it's interesting. You know, Trump never puts his own money into a deal. He likes to do things on credit. And that's a perfectly fine way to build an empire if you can pay your loans back, which he hasn't always been able to in the past. But he bought Turnberry from a Dubai-based company called Leisure Corp. And the deal is not really had much public scrutiny to this point. But there's a confidant of Trump's who plays on his golf courses, who's a Wall Street guy, and he was able to examine a lot of the documents, and he told me this could be a problem. You know, there's foreign money involved here. The problem is that Trump has repeatedly said he doesn't have any loans from Russian banks, and he's made a lot of declarations about where the money has come from, and it might be at odds with the financing of the Turnberry deal.
Alan, that makes me want to ask you a question. As far as you know, does special counsel Robert Mueller play golf?
Yeah, he loves the game. And my SI colleague, Michael Bamberger, who was, you know, part of the reporting of this Trump piece, he's one of the few people on the planet who's played golf with both Donald Trump and Robert Mueller. And he said this guy Mueller is by the book. Everything he does adheres to the rules of golf. He putts out every two-footer. He recoils at the thought of a gimme. I mean, he's basically the polar opposite of Donald Trump as a golfer and probably as a person. So those contrasting styles might be very interesting as his investigation continues. Now, I don't think that Mueller's going to investigate Trump 68 at Bel Air, but I think he's going to get into a lot of other things. And it's too bad they couldn't just go out and play an 18-hole match and the winner would get to decide the future of the free world. But I think it's going to be a little longer, drawn-out process, but it's certainly going to be interesting to see what Mueller turns up.
Alan Shipnuck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated, columnist for golf.com. Thanks, Alan.
Thanks for having me.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. On Wednesday, a couple of Republican senators introduced legislation to cut legal immigration by half over the course of a decade. Senators Tom Cotton of Arkansas and David Perdue of Georgia co-authored the bill. It's called the RAISE Act, Reforming American Immigration for Strong Employment. President Trump praised that bill to reporters yesterday.
This competitive application process will favor applicants who can speak English, financially support themselves and their families, and demonstrate skills that will contribute to our economy. The RAISE Act prevents new migrants and new immigrants from collecting welfare and protects U.S. workers from being displaced.
Now, shortly afterwards, senior policy advisor Stephen Miller gave a press briefing at the White House. But that briefing erupted when Jim Acosta of CNN asked a question about what America stands for when it comes to immigration.
The Statue of Liberty says, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. It doesn't say anything about speaking English or being able to be a computer programmer. Aren't you trying to change what it means to be an immigrant coming into this country if you're telling them you have to speak English? Can't people learn how to speak English when they get here?
There was an extraordinary back and forth after this. Stephen Miller had this to say.
I don't want to get off into a whole thing about history here, but the Statue of Liberty is a symbol of liberty and lighting the world. The poem that you're referring to that was added later is not actually part of the original Statue of Liberty.
That poem is the New Colossus. It was written by Emma Lazarus. The poem was added to the statue's pedestal in 1903 after the statue itself was dedicated in 1886. But Lazarus wrote that sonnet to help raise money for the statue's pedestal 3 years earlier. So we've been asking you for your take on where you think America stands on immigration and where we should stand in 2017.
This is Mark. I'm calling from Bradford, Massachusetts. My mother immigrated from Eastern Europe, from Romania to Vienna and eventually New York in 1921. I have always been amazed at what they had to go through to get here, beginning with the Russian pogrom of their village, to being homeless refugees, to eventually here in the United States. I am extremely proud to be the son of an immigrant, and my heart goes out to those being stopped or prevented by the new policies of the White House. This is not what that wonderful quote on the Statue of Liberty implies.
My name's Marie McManus. I'm calling from Dayton, Ohio. My grandparents were born in Utrecht, Holland. My grandmother came through Ellis Island when she was 16, and my grandfather when he was in his early 20s. They settled in Dayton, Ohio, and raised 11 Americans.
Kevin from Manchester, New Hampshire. Regarding immigration, I'm happy they're putting in an English requirement. If you look at some of the illegals that they have recently arrested, the parents don't speak English, and they've been here 20 years. So I think it's about time we do that. These people come in and take advantage of the system. They don't simulate. They create neighborhoods all by themselves.
Now, part of the Republican proposal says that people who learn English get a preference for immigration. And Julia Yaffe, who's a staff writer for The Atlantic and was born in Russia, tweeted this on Wednesday. She said, I didn't speak English when I immigrated to the United States. Now I get paid to write in it. Just saying.
This is Jim Curry, and I'm calling from Central Ohio. My grandparents on both sides came to the U.S. through Ellis Island between World War I and the Depression. I think often of what recent immigrants we are to this country and how lucky we are. We need to reflect on and embrace the words inscribed on the Statue of Liberty or risk the loss of what America really means.
Hi, this is Beth Hartwig from Schaumburg, Illinois. Of course, Americans don't still stand behind that message. Of course, to be fair, they never did. My Italian ancestors were poor and huddled and tired in the mid to late 1800s, and they weren't welcomed. It's a lovely yet empty sentiment.
You can call us at 8778-MYTAKE or head to the Takeaway's Facebook page. Since 9/11, the U.S. has prosecuted exactly 807 people for terrorism. The latest was just last month, on July 10th. It was the case of a U.S. Army sergeant in Hawaii who was caught in a sting operation by the FBI. Then there's the case of Ali Sharif Dimash, who was the first foreigner brought to the United States to face terrorism charges under the Trump administration. That was 2 weeks ago. The Intercept is tracking all of these cases through their new project. It's called Trial and Terror. Trevor Aronson is the co-creator of the project and a contributing writer at The Intercept. He joins me now. Trevor, welcome.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Well, 807 people in total prosecuted, as I mentioned. Break down for us some of the numbers of who they are, what the government says they've actually done, and how long they go to prison for, if at all.
Yeah, so of the 807, 298 have been involved in sting operations. And in those cases, the vast majority of defendants had no direct connections to international terrorist groups. These were people who got involved in plots where an FBI informant or an FBI undercover agent, you know, provided the means and the opportunity, in many cases providing the weapon, in other cases even providing the idea for an attack. In these cases, these are not examples necessarily of people who would have gotten involved in attacks on their own, but thanks to the government's intervention, thanks to the government's encouragement, got involved in attacks. And what's interesting about material support is that at its heart, in its truest meaning, what it's intended to do is prosecute someone who provided some sort of assistance to a real terrorist. So he, you know, helped a terrorist, for example, drive across the country or across the city to deliver a bomb, or he provided materials for a terrorist to make a bomb. And in its truest sense, that is what a material support prosecution would involve. But today, what we're seeing is that because of the interpretations in the court of material support, people who aren't even really connected to real terrorists are being charged with material support, because what the courts have upheld is that believing that you are helping a terrorist is enough to be charged with material support and convicted for material support, even if you aren't actually aiding a real terrorist. And by that, what I mean is through these sting operations, the FBI uses informants or undercover agents who pose as ISIS members or Al-Qaeda members, and they get people in the United States to somehow provide them with some sort of support. And so even though they are essentially helping an undercover FBI agent, because they think they are helping a real terrorist, they are then prosecuted for material support. It's a vague type of charge that allows the U.S. Department of Justice a very wide latitude in prosecuting individuals.
So material support can become this legal catch-all that interacts with this phenomenon of the sting operations. You mentioned about a third of the 807 cases you tracked were stings. In many cases, Trevor, as you mentioned, these are cases where the eventual defendants were never really in a position to commit violence. Sometimes they call these stage-managed operations with FBI undercover agents or other types of law enforcement. A lot of people might look at that, though, and say, isn't that exactly how you want it? If people think they're terrorists or think they're helping terrorists, even if they're not, isn't keeping them contained in some legal stage show and keeping them away from people with violence exactly what the average American would want?
And that's what the FBI would say, certainly. And the FBI would say that there are two benefits to this type of preemptive prosecution. And one benefit is that this is the type of person who maybe one day would really come across a real terrorist, and that real terrorist would provide them with the means to do some sort of terrible harm. And so this sting operation is getting that person off the street before that can happen. And then the second benefit is that, in the FBI's view, this creates a hostile environment for terrorism. So that, you know, if a real terrorist is out in the United States and is trying to conspire with other people, they will begin to think, well, hey, is this guy I'm talking to an FBI informant or undercover agent? And that will then undercut maybe some momentum they might get in trying to put together a plot. And those are valid. Those are valid arguments. I'm not going to say that they're not. But what I would raise is that there is a clear track record of the FBI being very good at finding these people who are at the earliest stages of wanting to get involved in terrorism. You know, they don't have connections to terrorists. They don't have weapons. And in some cases, they are mentally ill or they are financially desperate. And an FBI informant provides them with an incentive, such as money, to get involved in a plot. The question is whether they would have gone forward in any sort of plot had they met a real terrorist. And then the other point I would raise is that while the FBI has gotten very good at catching these guys who are this low-hanging fruit, the people who can be brought up in these sting operations, none of these sting operations have actually caught someone who was on the verge of an attack. They've never caught someone who had bombs or had weapons and had an actual plan. And, you know, just before he's able to move forward in that plan, is arrested by the FBI thanks to the sting operation. And so I think there is a question of whether the FBI is dedicating a lot of resources to people who are only capable of terrorism through these FBI sting operations, while at the same time missing the truly dangerous threats that, you know, to the FBI's credit, are very difficult to find, but might not be as difficult to find if so many resources weren't spent on these very questionable cases.
Well, one interesting related fact to that, Trevor Aronson, that you found is that about half of these 807 people who face charges have eventually been released with no supervision at all, which suggests the government doesn't really consider them dangerous.
Absolutely. You know, this was one of the reasons that we started to move forward in this project, was that we were looking at these terrorism prosecutions and realizing that half of them have resulted in defendants who have since been released. And I think it's an easy assumption to make by the average American that hey, these terrorism prosecutions are really serious, so they must involve people going to jail for decades, if not life in prison. While the truth is that the vast majority of defendants post-9/11 international terrorism cases have been sentenced to relatively minor sentences, you know, 6 years in some cases, a decade in prison. And we're now getting to this point in history where so many of these people are now being released. And in some cases, these will be people who were released for doing fairly minor things, such as maybe lying to an FBI agent. But in other cases, there are people who were involved in plots that the government described as deadly serious who have been released. An example is a group of men in Miami in 2006 that became known as the Liberty City Seven. They conspired with an FBI informant in a plot where they were allegedly going to, you know, place a bomb at the Sears Tower in Chicago, as well as bomb the North Miami FBI office. And, you know, fast forward to 2017, you know, all but one of those people has now been released. The last person will be released later this year. There is no government program to monitor them. And so the question is, if these guys were so dangerous in 2006 and they were described as terrorists who wanted to declare a ground war on the United States, how is it okay then for them to be released without any sort of supervision? I mean, does that suggest that after a short prison sentence, a terrorist is fully rehabilitated? Or I think more concerning, does it suggest that maybe these guys weren't really that dangerous in the first place?
Trevor Aronson is the co-creator of Trial and Terror, appearing in The Intercept. He's executive director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Trevor Aronson, thank you.
Thanks, Todd.
A couple of shocking new videos have emerged from Baltimore's beleaguered police department. Two police body camera videos out in the last 2 weeks allegedly show officers planting drugs at the scene of an arrest. The videos are still under investigation, but the first is from a case in January released on July 19th, and it seems to show an officer reenacting finding planted drugs.
You.
That's the first video, and the second, released this week of a separate incident, shows an officer's surprise at finding allegedly planted marijuana in the glove compartment of a car.
Well, here you go.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. I knew it. That's why they were freaking out.
That's the weed smell right there,
too. That's why they were freaking out.
Oh, these are like little fives.
Baltimore's police department is already under close federal attention. The department is under a civil rights consent decree from the Justice Department. And so far, over 100 cases in which the officers in the video were involved are under review. Kevin Rector is a police and crime reporter for the Baltimore Sun, and he explains how these videos even came to be.
There is a feature on officers' body cameras that is constantly recording a 30-second loop. And at the point at which an officer activates his or her camera, the camera retains that 30 seconds. So some people I've talked to have raised questions about why an officer would get himself in a situation like this, where it appears he's planting drugs in the first video in a backyard on his own camera. The police department has said that they've not reached any conclusions yet, but that one theory that they're investigating is that the drugs in question and the drugs being handled by the officers in these videos were in fact discovered legitimately. And then the officers said, oh man, that should have been on camera. I should have been recording when I made that discovery. So they did a reenactment.
The common sense says that these aren't the only two instances like this. What's the city saying?
What the police commissioner, Kevin Davis, has said is that the department is going through some growing pains. They initiated this body camera program in 2016. They're still in the process of rolling it out. Officers are still in the process of getting used to video. Sometimes they don't turn it on when they should, etc. Things like that. But it's something that I have heard for years from people in Baltimore that officers planted drugs on them.
And Baltimore is a city where the police department is already under a consent decree, where the nation watched the experience with Freddie Gray and alleged police brutality there.
Right. And so since then, I mean, the department is under a consent decree. It was last summer in August when the U.S. Department of Justice issued its rather scathing report finding that the police department routinely conducted discriminatory and unconstitutional policing, largely in Black, predominantly poor neighborhoods in the city. And in March, seven Baltimore police officers were indicted by federal prosecutors for racketeering. The allegations are that they robbed citizens and filed false court paperwork and put in claims, fraudulent claims for overtime. And that case has led to the Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby dropping, I think, more than 50 criminal cases that relied on the testimony of those seven officers. She's already taken steps subsequent to the release of this body camera footage to drop additional cases. I think in relation to the first body camera video, she has already dropped more than 40 cases. I think more than 50 are under review. In the second video, she's dropped a handful of cases, postponed a few others. So it's a question of not only the cases that are directly related to these videos, the cases in which these videos were recorded, but it becomes an issue for a large number of criminal cases in Baltimore because these officers who are involved obviously are involved in other criminal cases. And as the state's attorney's office has said, their integrity has come into question with the release of these videos.
Kevin Rector, police and crime reporter at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Americans' attitudes towards gender identity and gender expression seem to be changing, even as the message from the White House becomes increasingly hostile. Transgender Americans are slowly gaining greater acceptance. Just this week, the Commandant of the Coast Guard said he would not break faith with transgender personnel and would not enforce President Trump's ban on transgender service members in the military. But a less publicized debate is also reaching a pivotal moment. It involves children with congenital conditions that fall under the category intersex. Dr. Arlene Barretts is a radiologist in Pittsburgh and the mother of two intersex adults, and I spoke with her about some of the obstacles for intersex children, for their parents, and for physicians facing questions of gender and medical necessity.
Intersex refers to people who have conditions where their chromosomes, their gonads, or their genitals don't meet conventional notions of what it means to be male or female.
And how often today is surgery viewed as, I guess, what you would call a clinical solution, if one is even required?
It's hard to say that. About one in 2,000 children has a difference that's noticeable at birth, some kind of genital difference. And in those cases, sometimes surgery is viewed as a solution to what is thought to be a social problem of living with a different looking kind of body.
And it sounds like this is a medical debate, Dr. Barretts, that's being informed or maybe colored by notions of gender and what the demarcations in gender are.
Yes, that's correct. I think a lot of clinicians and people in society maybe have the idea that there is a binary idea of gender, that people fit into pink and blue boxes, that their bodies fit into those boxes, that their gender identities fit into those boxes. But when people are born with bodies or sex traits that don't fit into those boxes, I think it's natural to expect that the way they view themselves, in other words, their gender identity or the way they want to express themselves, their gender expression is going to also be non-binary or along a continuum as well.
And it sounds like all of this also points to another dilemma, which is if a surgical option is chosen, it's probably when the child is very, very young, and probably before you get the chance to ask any of these questions that you're talking about, or before they even have a gender identity.
These decisions are made before they're old enough to speak, much less express a gender identity. They're typically done in infancy, around 6 months to a year and a half. And so these children are irreversibly committed to bodies that are made to resemble one gender more than the other when they've had no opportunity at all, when their families have had no opportunity at all to even see who these children are.
Is it a good option then to wait till later, till the child is older? Is there an ideal age to have these conversations? And then if something like surgery is an option that the family or the patient wants, you can resort to it later.
A report has come out from an organization called Human Rights Watch in conjunction with an intersex group called Interact Advocates for Intersex Youth. And that report found that there have been violations of children's human rights to bodily integrity, to autonomy, to determine what they want their own bodies to look like. And I believe that in order to give children that autonomy, we need to have a process rather than some kind of age cutoff, a process where we're educating them about their bodies, we're supporting them to live in society the way they are. We already have this kind of process in place for kids with gender dysphoria, some of whom grow up to be transgender. We don't do that for families or children who are intersex. They often end up being isolated. At times, they're not offered support from peer support groups where there are other families who can talk to them, where there are other kids that they can relate to. And even in the hospital or the clinic setting, there are not that many resources that are devoted to giving them psychological and emotional support.
Now, you have some personal experience with this yourself, Dr. Barretts. As I mentioned, you've raised two intersex children of your own who are now adults. What did that experience teach you, and what drove you to become an activist in this issue?
I started medical school in 1980. And our very first year in our classes, we were learning about the development of the fetus. We learned about intersex conditions. And what we were told was that there are discrepancies between people's physical appearance and what their chromosomes or gonads might be, or that they have genitals that are not one or the other. And that when this happens, it's an emergency and something has to be done to fix it. And after you fix it, you should do it when people are younger, and you should make up a story to explain it. You can't tell them the truth. Because if the child found out, it was thought that they would commit suicide. So I learned about this condition in my children when they were young, 6 and 4 years old. And so my feeling 10 years later when this was discovered was that here I'm raising children, and if they find anything out about this, they're going to commit suicide, which was just devastating. Eventually, a doctor did direct me to some support, and it was life-saving. It was the most wonderful thing that had happened to me. And after that, I became very involved, and I just decided that I did not want anyone else to go through the loneliness and isolation that I had gone through.
The report from Human Rights Watch is out. Several surgeons general, as we mentioned, have come out against routine surgery for intersex children. Where would you like to see information for parents of intersex children go?
What I would like to see is for families at the outset to start talking to people who can support them, both professionals like social workers, psychologists, nurses, child life specialists, and also the people who are the real experts on raising those children, and those are other parents. I'd like them to talk to those families and those people in the clinic to find out what it's really like to raise a child with this kind of difference, to find out that many people are raising these children with the bodies that they were born with, and that these children are very happy and healthy. We all love our children, and we all want to do what's best for them and to solve problems for them that they might have in the future. But in this situation, this might be something that their children don't want later on.
Dr. Arlene Barretts, I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Arlene Barrett is a radiologist in Pittsburgh, an activist for families with intersex children, and a mother of two intersex adults.
I am Merida, firstborn descendant of Clan Dunbrock, and I'll be shooting for my own hand.
Christmas Eve, he phones in one of those radio call-in shows, tells them, I need a new wife.
Oh, you're kidding. That's so sweet.
Now he's obsessed with this one woman who wrote me.
You serious?
Yeah, she wants to meet me at the top of the Empire State Building.
On Valentine's Day.
You have a choice. We have a choice. Right now. Ever since the comet was discovered, we've been hoping and working for the best. But we've also been planning for the worst.
Oh!
Oh my God!
Naked!
Why are you
wet? Don't look at me! Do you know, just go.
Fine.
Go take a shower, you stink.
Nice tattoo, by the way.
Never let your guard down. You expect a battle to be fair. A battle will never be fair.
What do some of those films you're hearing there have in common? Those are some of the top grossing films ever directed by women. There are 1,438 directors, writers, and producers behind the 100 top grossing films of 2016. And of all of those creative people, less than one in five is female. That's a finding published by the University of Southern California's Annenberg School. They analyzed the top 900 grossing movies over the last 9 years to identify who's being represented in Hollywood, both on screen and behind the camera. They also found that of the speaking characters in the 100 top movies of 2016, less than a third were women, and non-white groups also accounted for less than a third. And of all those top 900 grossing movies of the last 9 years, there were just 34 unique female directors. Joining me now to talk about some of the challenges of breaking into Hollywood is Gillian Robespierre, co-writer and director of several movies, including Obvious Child and Landline. Gillian Robespierre, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. What was your reaction to some of those numbers from the report that I just quoted?
I guess they always make my stomach churn a little bit, but I've been pretty well aware of those numbers for a long time. I worked on the other side of the film industry for about 7 years before I directed Obvious Child, and I worked at the Directors Guild of America, where those numbers and stats were being told to me on a weekly basis. And also when I first started film school, I entered into the world thinking I would be an editor or perhaps a documentary filmmaker. I never thought I would have the ability or chance to break into directing. I didn't have many female filmmaker role models to sort of look at. Nicole Holofcener was a big idol for me in the 90s and sort of made me realize that I could tell stories, and personal ones and human stories, and that there was an appetite for them. And that sort of encouraged me to try. But it did take a while, and I think no matter what gender you are, it's really difficult to break into Hollywood. And my advice, and I hate giving advice, but it's maybe not to do it the traditional way, and just to go out and tell your story on a very low budget and with a small crew and with without really asking for permission. And hopefully your story and film resonates and you can enter the business that way on your own terms.
In the real world of filmmaking and directing, what are some of the main obstacles for women breaking in, for women of color breaking in, frankly, for anyone who's not a white guy director to break in?
Yeah, it's giving the opportunity. And I think that that's the hardest part of breaking into anything, is just getting your first shot at it. But part of that is not asking for anyone's permission, but to go out and do it yourself. Cameras are so available. Creative, intelligent, smart collaborators are, I think, always willing to take a little bit of a pay cut to tell an interesting story. So again, it's just really to go about it in a creative way, and to not necessarily find your money through typical investors or production companies, but to get a tapestry of finances together, whether that's using Kickstarter or, you know, finding a couple of angel investors, but to also keep your first film sort of manageable and in terms of the budget. Don't go out and make, you know, Wonder Woman the first time around.
Gillian Robespierre, we had director Julie Dash on the show last year in late September. She talked about breaking into Hollywood as an African-American woman. Listen.
Hollywood is clubby because they, I believe they see themselves as the curators of culture. Therefore, if you present to them something that they've never heard of before or that it doesn't have anything to do with their personal or familial legacy, they like, thank you for submitting. Thank you for your time. Adios.
Thank you for your time. Adios. Because the curators of culture don't want you in the club.
Yeah. I was lucky that with my first movie, Obvious Child, that it wasn't necessarily the curators who had a say in liking it. It was really the audience was very ready to see this story of a woman having an abortion and having it in a very realistic way. And I think that the community was really excited about Obvious Child, and then maybe Hollywood followed their lead, which was really nice. And it started a conversation with Landline, my latest movie. I went a more traditional route, and the door opened up a little bit, and I worked with a production company through development and shooting it and editing it, and had a more traditional journey of making this movie. And there's pros and cons. You know, it's really nice to have a little bit more money to tell your story. It's nice to have the ability to pay cast and crew a little bit more than, you know, pizza money. But there are challenges when there are more voices and more money involved, for sure.
So it sounds like, Gillian Robespierre, what you're saying is that if this is going to change the representation of women, not only in front of the camera, but behind the camera, that you're not going to be able to wait for the Directors Guild to change things, or certainly Hollywood producers, that young women directors just got to do it. They got to raise the money, get grassroots, and make projects that people are going to want to see.
Hopefully it's a combined effort. But yes, I think to break in, it has to be and can only be, at this moment, a little more grassroots than having the door just be the opportunities to be available. Unfortunately, they're just not at this moment.
Gillian Robespierre, co-writer and director of Obvious Child and Landline, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You might recognize that music there. That's from Julia Child's cooking show, The French Chef, which aired in the 1960s. You know, before she became a culinary cultural icon, though, Julia Child was once trying to get her cookbook published. It was called Mastering the Art of French Cooking.
The gentleman of the publishing company called Mrs. Child in, and they said, Mrs. Child, nobody, no woman in America wants to know this much about French cooking. Well, I did. Sorry.
That's Judith Jones being interviewed by WNYC in 2007. She's the literary editor who discovered Julia Child. Jones passed away this week at 93 years old. Jones established more than a new generation of culinary literati. She also edited all but one of John Updike's works and translated French philosophers like Albert Camus. But one of Judith Jones' other major career milestones was saving probably the world's most celebrated diary. As a young editorial assistant, Jones convinced her editors to publish Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl, in English in the United States. And that brought Anne Frank's work to the English-speaking world. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.